I've been very impressed by the accounts of the young speakers several weeks ago regarding their struggles with life chances. And I'm sure they brought back memories to those of us of a certain age who recall our own struggles with life-altering decisions, especially as we tried to balance religious beliefs with secular definitions and notions of success. Sometimes I think it's hard enough for young people than it was for my generation. And the suggestion from this Sunday is Springs of the Water and Life. That's the suggested title. And given our experiences this spring, we might have wished for a different metaphor, I think. But nevertheless, we might conjure up a different image of flowing water, which, like life itself, meets various obstacles through the course of its movements. There are rocks, abutments, islands, all of which the water must navigate around or through. There are even dams which face the flow of water. As a religion that provides guidance in our lives, Christianity, it seems to me, can be quite complex, resulting in a multiple interpretations of what it means to be a Christian. This does not make life decisions any easier. On the one hand, believers can become rule-bound and limited by those rules. On the other hand, they can become self-satisfied free agents, convinced that God will always forgive them of their sins. Perhaps one reason for the wide variety of interpretations of the scripture and the expressions of Christianity is that the central figure of the founding story is not a king-like person. He's not a person who dictates principles and orders. Rather, he is a man crucified as a criminal. And in an article in the opinion piece of the New York Times over Easter, the writer, Peter Winger, raises the interesting issue that Christianity, again, is the only religion without a king-like, monarch-like figure, but rather a person who dies like a criminal. He does not go into battle, the main figure of Christianity. He does not proclaim a rigid set of laws. He is someone who rather participates in the human condition, and in so doing, does not banish doubt or evil, but rather demonstrates the power of love and redemption in dealing with these issues. In the midst of a world that seems to be in constant turmoil, both in our public and in our private lives. The story of the crucifixion is not a story of conquest that crushes out the existence of the presence of injustice and evil. It's a story of atonement, a story where the central figure takes on the mantle of human suffering and sin, and thereby not only acknowledges the trials and weaknesses of humankind, but shares in a dramatic way their consequences. The solution Jesus offers to the agonies of the world is not retribution, but forgiveness, an act that ends the cycle of conflict between individuals and also within ourselves. You recall the words of Christ on the cross, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." But also note the words, my God, why hast thou forsaken me?" These are not words of a monarch or of a king. These are words of a person who dies, as the author of this article says, like a criminal. Historical figures like Gandhi and Nelson Mandela and Mother Teresa illustrate the positive consequences of exercising love rather than retribution, something that most of us find extremely difficult to do because in our religion, evil is not actually eradicated, evil is something that we have to deal with and overcome. We are not offered a release from suffering in Christianity. We are not offered a release from doubt or confusion in the course of our lives. Rather, what we are offered is the assurance that God is with us in our suffering, as he was with Christ on the cross, even though we are told that Christ himself wondered if God had abandoned him. We are told that love and understanding and compassion are required to be free of the bonds of hatred and resentment. But is knowing this helpful? Or is it merely a commentary of sharing a story of pain, rather like friends who think they are being helpful to us in our moments of doubt and pain by giving us accounts of their troubles or saying, oh yes, I've been there too. That often is not very helpful. So we are not offered definite answers of why there is suffering and wrongdoing, unless, of course, one accepts a literal interpretation of Adam and Eve. But even so, we might rightfully ask, why does evil continue to persist? Why is pain still with us? We are only offered the hope that good can be recovered, that forgiveness is possible, that we can move on, that if we can be forgiven, we should forgive others. Last week, I read a review of two recent books that focus on why some societies thrive while others disintegrate. One of the books focused on the necessity for life-sustaining environment. You have to have adequate food and adequate material possessions, etc. Societies that have that amount of riches tend to be more peaceful than those who do not. But the other book focused on how people deal with each other within a given society. And in the second book, the author cites the case in the 19th century of survivors of two different shipwrecks existing simultaneously in two different locations on the Auckland Island off the coast of Australia. Sorry, not off the coast of Australia, off the coast of New Zealand. The captain of one group was a hard driver who had stressed the idea of competition to get his crew to work harder. It was like every man for himself and get out there and do your thing. As a result, because of an ethic of every man for himself, only three of the original 19 survived their ordeal of existing on this island. And their survivors told tales of fighting, of murder, and even of cannibalism. The captain of the second group on the other side of the island had stressed teamwork and responsibility for fellow mates during their days at sea. There were only five that survived the shipwreck, but they existed in a very well manner because they shared the resources they could find, and all of them survived, and when they were found, they were all in good health. And apparently, I just read the reviews of these two books, but apparently in that book, the author goes on to point out the necessity for a society to continue, the necessity for caring for other people, and necessity for sharing goods. Last month, while Mary Dean and I were in North Carolina, in Nashville, North Carolina, we saw the movie The Best of Enemies. It's based on a true story of the confrontation in the 1960s between the white male leader of the local Ku Klux Klan in Raleigh, North Carolina, and a very forceful black woman leader of the local civil rights movement. The leader of the Ku Klux Klan had been practicing intimidation of the black population or anybody who sympathized with the black population. And the black leader of the civil rights challenged him on this. And tensions mounted until a mediator came from the Fellowship of Reconciliation, which was an organization at that time. And he worked with the two antagonists. His role was to calm them down and to try to get them to understand the motivation and the characterizations of their opponents. And at one point, he forced them to sit down at the same table and eat together. And you could see them sort of staring at each other and not knowing what to say. In any case, I'd recommend the film if it comes to Montreal. But through the efforts of the mediator, the militant Ku Klux Klan leader eventually ended up withdrawing his attacks on the local black movement. And the black leader was gracious in accepting his change of perspective. It didn't make the black leader of the KKK popular with his own followers, but it did reduce the violence that was in Raleigh at the time. For me, the film illustrated the braveness and the boldness of what it takes to deal with injustice and evil. Injustice and evil was not banished by a king-like savior. It still exists. And his answer was, it's not retribution of solving one evil act with a counter-evil act, but rather understanding how the evil can be overcome through efforts to understand the nature of one's adversaries, and then to have the strength of conviction and the resilience to participate in its reconciliation. It's too bad that many of our political leaders don't follow that, it seems to me. I think we need to strengthen the belief in reconciliation and atonement, especially now in times of extreme uncertainty and with the rise of radical movements. This does not mean being passive, but it does mean recognizing that our protagonists, like us, are fallible human beings, and that the principle of love, atonement, and restitution should be parts of our fundamental premise of how we live our lives and how we deal with others. We need to be active in demonstrating these principles. There are examples that we know about. This past year, we did some studying of attempt at reconciliation between Mennonite farmers in Alberta, I believe it was, with Indigenous people over land claims. And we saw an example there of what discussion and negotiations can do. I have one further thought along this line. Alan Paton, a famous apartheid-era South African author of Cry the Beloved Country, wrote in the turbulent 1960s the short book called Instrument of Thy Peace. It's largely an interpretive work of the writings of St. Francis of Assisi. And in it, he pointed out that we should not be distracted from the central message of Christ by biblical accounts that might seem inconceivable. For example, would it really matter, he asks, if Jesus' body had in fact been stolen from his tomb, perhaps by a grave robber who hoped to find some valuable items belonging to Jesus, who many declared was King of the Jews? The point Paton is trying to make is, we should hold fast to the more important issue, the central thesis that the Son of God took on the frailties of humanity, and that retribution was not the aim. Rather, the aim was to preserve, to understand, to exert compassion for our fellow human beings, and acting on these premises, we could further the compassion of others. Symbolic religious practices can also get in the way of activity seeking to reduce human suffering. Jesus pointed this out in the criticism of religious leaders of his time, the scribes and the Pharisees. I can remember one incident, a minor one, long ago, during my time in Korea after the war. Our relief unit received an emergency call on a Sunday to help flood victims. There was a lot of flooding in the spring during the rainy season because of the deforestation of the hills of Korea. Korea is a very hilly country. And there are terraces of rice paddies there. And when the flooding comes, it's quite disastrous. In any case, we received the call on a Sunday. And one member of the unit felt that we could not possibly respond because Sunday was a holy day, and it would violate the religious purpose of Sunday, a day of rest and worship. We had a bit of an argument about it, but fortunately, our team moved out and carried out the needed operations on a Sunday. I cite that because oftentimes we can get a little bit confused in terms of some issues in the Bible or some symbols of our religion that prevent us from acting in a way, in a compassionate way, in a way of love and understanding. At a personal level, in our darkest hours of grief and anger and frustration and resentment, of self-incrimination, of self-loathing, it is often difficult to remember that we are offered through the prism of practicing love and forgiveness, both toward others as well as to ourselves, the hope of release and understanding, and the promise of renewal. Again, this is not to argue that we remain oblivious to evil. Evil exists. It is not to argue that we remain passive and detached. It is rather to emphasize that the cycle of evil and counter-evil can only be ended through laying bare the causes and consequences of what we believe are injustices, and to do so in the spirit of love and reconciliation. And I think this is radically different from prescribing a list of commands for destruction designed to eradicate our antagonists, whether they are other persons, other nations, or from within our own selves. This, I think, is the reason why Jesus did not portray himself as a conquering hero. As one author pointed out, he's right on this. He claims that this is the only religion in which the central figure is not a hero, like a king or a monarch, and acts in that way. The story about Jesus, it seems to me, offers us the more effective and enduring and life-supporting response of understanding, compassion, love, and redemption for others, but also for ourselves.